Well, hi there. Welcome back to the show. We're back at it again. I'm going to start off at the top here with one of our favorite segments, reading reviews from Apple Podcasts. Now, if you're new to the show, welcome in. Hi there. You can do this. You can go to Apple Podcasts and rate the show 5 stars if you feel so inclined and leave a review, and I'll read your review on the show, and I'll even review you back, or I'll say whatever you want me to say. I'll shout something out, or I'll sing happy birthday to someone, or I'll say hi to your dog. That's always fun. And it works like this. This is the one I'm reading today. It's called I Love Rolling with Austin. And it says, People Pleaser is such a fun, chill, and informative podcast. Much like the man, the myth, the legend himself, this pod is full of humor, insight, and depth for anyone interested in growing and learning. I love the variety of guests and subjects broached, as well as Austin's signature voice to guide the audience through each episode. I hope People Pleaser continues to please all the people that are lucky enough to listen. Well, that's just a very nice review, and I also hope that People Pleaser continues to please people. This was written by Scone514. Now, here's the problem, folks. I don't know who this is, so if you're out there, Scone514, I would have said something very nice about your smile or about something that I know about you, but instead all I can say is just thank you for this very nice review and for informing me that I have a signature voice. I don't know if you people knew that, listening wherever you are, but I apparently have a signature voice, so thank you, Scone514. Couple quick things here before we get going. My guest today, great guy, a friend from the Utah theater scene and also a co-host of 2 podcasts. One is called Thank God I'm Atheist and the other is called The How To Heretic. So you can probably guess from the titles of those podcasts that a big part of what he does outside of acting is he kind of offers a voice for the atheist community and criticism of religion. So we spend a little bit at the top of the episode talking about our religious upbringing and how that may or may not have affected our mental health. And I just want to say at the top of the episode, Dan says this in the interview, but I want to make sure that I say right at the top that we are not experts on anything that we're talking about, and we are not speaking from a position of authority or making declarative, definitive statements about any of this stuff. We're just offering our anecdotal experience. The other thing I want to talk about right at the top is I recorded this with Dan over Zoom, and I've done a few of these over the last few weeks, and I'm learning bit by bit how to do it smarter and better. And since Dan's a podcaster, he was able to record his own audio on his own microphone while we did the Zoom call. But since I hadn't done it that way before, I had the Zoom audio of our talk in the background. So I was able to line up his audio for the most part with the audio of the Zoom call, but every once in a while the Zoom call audio would lag, and so you'll every once in a while hear the slightest bit of a weird distant echo on his voice, and you might be wondering, Austin, why didn't you just mute the Zoom call or put on headphones? And there's a simple answer for that. It's because I'm not very smart. So, okay. And the other thing is, I've said this on the top of the last few episodes, and I just want to say it again, that I want to hear from you. So if there's anything in this conversation that rubs you the wrong way or inspires you or makes you just want to be part of the conversation, DM me on the People Pleaser Instagram, and maybe we'll put that on the show, okay? All right, here's the episode. For a topic so bleak, I'm about to offer some really high hopes. This conversation started primarily with a Facebook post that my guest Dan made, where he basically just let his friends and family know that he was struggling with a resurgence of some depression and anxiety. I've wanted to cover this topic on the show since the very start, but I've avoided it, I think, for fear of getting it wrong or focusing on the wrong things or not covering it comprehensively enough. I actually think it's this very fear that keeps so many of us from even beginning to look at these two things. The fear that our efforts will not be enough. After all, who do I think I am to tackle such infamous universal foes as the tag team harbingers of mental anguish themselves, depression and anxiety? Better to leave it to the professionals and keep my insignificant and unnecessary take out of it, right? I mean, that seems reasonable. I don't have the answer. But Dan's simple Facebook post reminded me of something. There is no answer. There is no arrival point or finality to these conditions, at least not one that we've discovered so far in our extensive efforts. So far, these things, as far as we can tell, are simply part of the experience of being a conscious entity. That might sound kind of defeatist, but I don't mean at all to say that depression and anxiety are, therefore we shouldn't bother trying to understand or combat them. What I'm saying is that in remembering that these aren't problems with any concrete answers, I am reminded and assured that I am under no obligation to solve them for all humanity when I dare to publicly talk about them. And you aren't either. In fact, one of the only things that I can guarantee about this conversation is that it will be massively inadequate when it comes to fully unpacking all there is to know and all we hope to know about these two titan forces of mental instability. But that doesn't mean that this conversation or conversations like it are pointless or not worth having. I actually think this conversation works as a great companion piece to the most recent episode of this show, the conversation I had with John Lane about free will and determinism, where we talked at length about how so much of our individual experience is the result of programming that originates entirely outside of our control. In that episode, I landed on a position that I currently hold, which basically agrees with the deterministic viewpoint that I am acted upon by programming that I do not create or choose or control, but that within this framework, I, as a conscious, intelligent being, am an agent of choice, capable of disobeying or breaking my hardwired programming if I wish. Now, it's probably true that much of my behavior can be accounted for by my blind adherence to my built-in programming. But I believe that I am capable, on some level, of choice. Because if I didn't believe that, then I would think a conversation like the one you're about to hear would be pointless. After all, if I truly have zero ability to affect my mental state and my feelings, behaviors, and circumstances are all purely deterministic conditions outside of my control, then why would I even bother trying to rewrite the programming at all? Why would I think that such a thing would even be possible? Luckily, I believe that I do have a choice. I believe that when my depression wants me to lay in bed watching people debate things on YouTube for 12 hours straight, whether it feels like it or not, I actually do have the choice to get up and get a glass of water. I have a choice to do the dishes, and if I really want to push it, I believe I have a choice to stretch out and take a quick walk/jog around the neighborhood. It's certainly not easy. In fact, it's quite often extremely difficult. But it remains an option that is open to me nonetheless. And that's where I believe conversations like these begin. In an attempt to get outside of fear, discomfort, self-doubt, and fatigue, and try to begin to take conscious steps toward a new experience. And yeah, a single conversation isn't going to cure me or you or anyone. It's not going to permanently rewrite the code of our very complex hardwiring. But maybe it can be a small step toward acceptance. a step toward inner peace, toward presence, gratitude, understanding, and ultimately, hopefully, toward love. So here's a conversation. One small, inadequate conversation offered in the hope that it can be added to a tapestry of many conversations and many small efforts to live with these baffling conditions. And maybe the idea is that if you string enough of these small efforts together and you combine them with professional help and you do hard daily work to disobey your sometimes unfortunate programming, you can go beyond simply living with these conditions and you can actually arrive at a place where you begin to thrive and truly enjoy your life. Like I said, high hopes. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in my one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with actor, podcaster, husband, dog dad, and friend, Dan Beecher, about depression and anxiety. We could also make a case that our upbringing and the way that we were raised maybe contributes to some of this fear that we feel and discomfort that we feel when things like this come up. And I watched another video the other day that was about just the concept of hell as child abuse, you know, that like teaching a kid that like things that are kind of intrinsic parts of them are going to land them in eternal punishment is child abuse, and that it can contribute to lifelong fear and lifelong feelings of intrinsic inadequacy. And I wonder if you believe or feel that a religious upbringing in any way contributes to depression and anxiety for you still to this day.
You know, speaking for myself, I probably, but not because of anything that, you know, anyone else did to me other than just teaching me the tenets of a religion as though they were true. No, my parents were really cool. They were very liberal. They weren't locked down like very intense Mormons. They were very gentle about, you know, me finding my own path.
Yeah.
And yet I still believed what I heard when I went to church every week. And that was enough for me. And I was one of these people who, like, I believed hard. Like, I went zealous about it. And I think that it really messed me up a lot, actually. It's so funny because, like I say, I was surrounded by people who were the easiest on me that you can imagine.
Me too.
Mormonism can be crazy intense,
yeah,
depending on which Mormons you're surrounded by. If you've got, you know, a dictatorial bishop and you've got parents that are super, super intense about it, it can get really, really traumatic. For me, it wasn't. And yet the dogma had me so messed up. And I'm doing this, you know, I'm basically doing this to myself, but because I'm believing all of these grown-ups who are saying, you know, all of this is good, all of this is true, all of this is real. And then I, you know, which is fine when you're a kid, you're just like, okay, I'll just go to church and I'll believe in Jesus and all of that's fine. And then you come out and then, you know, you start to get older and you start to realize that, oh, like a lot of the things, a lot of my life hasn't been nice. Like a lot of people have been mean, and that doesn't seem like it gels with what I've been learning in church. And then, you know, you start to feel sexual urges and I tortured myself about sexuality. Like I was, you know, I masturbated and then I would feel crazy amounts of guilt, like insane amounts of guilt for something that is so normal and probably just beneficial and nice and fun. And I just racked myself. I tortured myself about it. And then when girls started participating with me in my sexuality, I feel so bad for the girls that I dated when I was a teenager, because it was just like, we'd do stuff, I'd touch their boobs or whatever, we'd make out, and then the next day I'd be like, oh, we can't do this ever again. I'm a bad person. And that's fucking torture for them. Like, yeah. That's no person you want to date. And so I think, yeah, even with the lightest touch, I think religion did a number on me. You know, there's a woman named Dr. Marlene Winnell, who I've interviewed on my shows, and she's a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I don't remember which, but she is trying to get the sort of body scientific to recognize a concept that she calls religious trauma, religious trauma syndrome is what it's called, and you know, it has very specific markers, and it's you can see it. She's studied it for years now, and it's clear as day that religion causes trauma, and that it that trauma lingers well into adulthood, and needs to be dealt with. It can be the cause of depression. It can be the cause of anxiety, all kinds of things.
Wow. What's her name again?
Marlene Winnell.
Marlene Winnell.
If you Google religious trauma syndrome, you'll find her.
Religious trauma syndrome. I haven't heard of that. And that actually, I'm kind of glad that someone's trying to get it cataloged or categorized, yeah. You know, because I don't think that you can just kind of discount that. And obviously depression and anxiety are also just kind of like, they seem to be just human conditions. They seem to be, there's lots of factors. There's things about just our evolutionary hardwiring, where right. It's just kind of like fear responses and just responses of just survival instinct. There's a lot of things at play that are, it's not just, it's multifactorial, you know, it's.
Hell, there's body chemistry that just can be fucked up, and then there you are.
That you just have, you develop weird, you know, dopamine dependencies or responses to, you know, just stimuli responses that your brain gets used to firing. And so it misfires in the wrong scenarios. And then suddenly you're just incredibly nervous for no reason. And then you can't turn off that switch. And there's all different kinds of, factors to that. I wonder, what's your kind of personal history with this? Because the reason I reached out to you, obviously, is I saw this kind of Facebook post where you were being very open and vulnerable, to use that very popular buzzword, sort of. In public, though, during this very kind of unsure, uncertain, scary time where everyone, I think the species is just feeling a heightened amount of anxiety right now, and a heightened amount of kind of fear and hopelessness. And it was nice to see you sort of share openly about it. But one thing that I noticed is you said this is the worst it's been in, I think you said 15 years. So I wonder kind of what's your history with it personally, and what happened that maybe helped curtail it for that 15-year period where it was lessened. If you wouldn't mind, I mean, you, as many details yeah. as you feel comfortable with.
Well, you know, I also have ADHD, mm-hmm. Usually is sort of comorbid with anxiety and depression, or it can be. It's very mm-hmm. common for that to happen. So, you know, going back well into my childhood, I was in therapy in, I think, third grade for depression and anxiety.
Wow.
And so, in and out of therapy through most of my childhood and my teen years, part of it was just, being the ADHD kid, being the kid, you know, the sad kid or whatever, it actually, you know, to some extent it can paint a target on you, right? The other kids see it as you know, they smell the weakness and they got to go after it. Mm-hmm. And I don't blame any of that on the kids, because that's just what kids do. But I ended up being an outcast for a long time in my childhood. And as I advanced through junior high and high school years, I had to make a concerted study of the other kids just to see. I watched and like took note of what they were all doing that was different than me, like what they're wearing, how they're talking, all of this sort of stuff, because I was so different that I didn't understand how to be okay. All I knew was that I wasn't cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know how that worked. And I think actually what's funny is that me making those concerted efforts to be more like, or at least to present more like them, helped a lot. Mm-hmm. I started being a little, and also, you know, kids outgrow being quite so mean. So, you know, as I got into high school and whatever, people were less mean and I felt more accepted. So that actually helped. So the worst of it was junior high age, or, you know, maybe early high school. That was sort of the hardest time. And also, you know, when you're a teenager, when you're a high school kid, you don't know anything. You don't know how the world works. You don't know what's permanent. You don't know if people hurting you is forever now, or if it gets better. You don't understand any of that stuff. So everything's kind of an emergency. And as I got older, things got better. I always had these disorders following me around, but, you know, it wasn't the weight of the world anymore. It was just these sort of things that I deal with, and it's fine. You know, you'd rather not have it. You'd rather be able to, you know, do school the way everybody does school. 'Cause even through my college years, I'm a reasonably smart dude. I've, I tested really well all through schooling. And so they wanted me in these more advanced programs in elementary and high school and whatever. And then I would do terribly on the classwork and whatever, because my anxiety, I was a perfectionist, because, you know, anxiety kind of does this crazy thing where if you can't do it perfectly, you might as well fail completely rather than like middle ground feels sketchy.
Yeah, yeah.
So I failed. I like my cumulative grade point average in high school is like a 1.9 or something like that.
Yeah.
So then, I got the GED and I went to college eventually, and I did better in college, but I still failed a lot. I still couldn't bring myself to do a lot of the homework. These were not habits that I knew how to develop, that I hadn't developed. So that was hard. But those that just sort of followed me. I would just, you know, it would ebb and flow, but I certainly wasn't, you know, suicidal or anything like that. The hardest thing for me, the big sort of spike for me after that was when my first wife, she was also depressed, and she decided to try a medication for it. And unfortunately, very, very rarely, but it is possible for a depression medication to make your depression significantly worse. And that was that was the side effect that she got, lucky her, and she fell into a hole that she could not get out of. And I ended up being a caretaker for her. Rather than, you know, it wasn't a husband relationship. It was like, I'm caring for her. And that was, you know, a couple years of that. And then eventually, you know, things were so bad, and we were going to couples therapy, and, you know, she was so bad off. And this is, again, I'm not blaming her at all.
Yeah.
But she was so bad off that she couldn't bring herself to get to the couples therapy sessions on time.
Yep.
Or at all sometimes. And so it was just like this thing where she was incapable of even working on the marriage. And I was depressed. We were both just, it just wrecked us. And so that was my second real low point. And that was the thing 15 or 20 years ago that mm-hmm. really, that was really hard. And it took, and that one, I it took, I had a really great therapist. And unfortunately, I'm resistant to most drugs. I'm not sure why. I like almost all medicine, and even illicit drugs, my body metabolizes the shit out of them, and then they don't have any effect. So for me, it was just a matter of concerted effort with a therapist, and then, you know, things got a lot better. And it was and what's interesting is that it was working on me that helped. It was working on me being the person that I wanted to be, me being, you know, a stronger, more someone who knew what he was and what he wanted and all of those things. That was what actually brought me out of the depression. Was being a better version of myself.
Yeah,
and reaching for it, you know, not necessarily being that, but just the striving for it was very helpful.
Sometimes even that can sound so out of reach for people when they're when they're in it, because and that can be such a debilitating and hopeless message too. Is like, you know what finally helped is like I just had to want it or something like that, you know. And I agree with you, because it's like the things that have saved me are when I finally somehow needed it bad enough or was desperate enough that I was willing to accept kind of any potential measures and really willing to like kind of sacrifice some ego to trying things that people were telling me rather than saying that won't help. You don't understand. My condition is so particularly difficult that like, but also like, I totally empathize. Like you said about your ex-wife, that it's like, you don't blame her. It's very difficult in that place when someone says, well, you just have to want it. You have to give a shit. And you're like, well, I do want it. I want it so bad, and I can't bring my. It's difficult for me to put my socks on in the morning. Yeah. You know, it's difficult for me. It's physically hard to act. People always say it's hard for me to roll out of bed or to get out of bed. But honestly, physically hard to get
absolutely
out of bed. Yeah,
there are a lot of very interesting. And I want to disclaim that I am by no means an expert. I'm just talking about my own experience.
Of course.
No one should take mental health advice from a podcast. That's just blanket. Unless it's a podcast that is run by a doctor, I would say that. But my own personal experience has been that if you, for me, it wasn't you have to want it. It was just. It got to the point where I couldn't not do it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like there was no direction to go but up.
Yeah.
And up was the scariest, hardest direction I could choose. So I could lay on the ground in the hole, or I could, you know, just take a step.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, you know. And what's nice about therapy is that you don't even have to pick which steps. You have to pick that step. You have to pick the step of going to therapy.
Uh-huh.
And then this other person starts asking you questions and you just answer them. You know what I mean? And hopefully you can start to question your own stories, and you know, you can start to get more perspective on what's really going on with you beyond just your own horrific feelings about things.
Uh-huh.
Because that's the thing. Our feelings are liars. Our feelings don't tell us who we are. They don't tell us what's actually happening in the world. They don't tell us anything. You know what I mean? My therapist at one point said that feelings are the exhaust. They are not the gasoline that drives the car.
Yeah. I like that.
So we have to sort of eventually find a way to trick ourselves into not believing our feelings. And to just plow forward in spite of feelings.
Yeah.
Something along those lines.
Absolutely. There's all these dichotomies that I think make it really difficult to begin that process of taking a step or choosing a place to go it is stuff like that. It's like, simultaneously not trusting your feelings, but picking which feelings to trust, because there is some part of you that's kind of like tenderly calling out. I always found it to be, and this is one of those things where I'm like, in my experience, Mormons got this right, that like my true self seems to speak to me in a much more quiet tone than my inaccurate anxieties and fears do. My inaccurate anxieties and fears kind of like scream at me, and like my ego, and it screams out like, we're on fire, you know, and my true self in my lowest moments had a way of kind of coming to me and going, hey man, I think you need to call someone. I think you need to like get on the phone. And it's weird because it's like, hey, how come you can't speak up? Like these other guys are yelling. I need you to, you know. So it's a matter of picking which voices in your head to listen to and which feelings to listen to. So there's those dichotomies of like having to sift through that. And then there's the dichotomy of like, very rarely can people recover from stuff like this on their own. Usually it requires some sort of external intervention, and but also that external intervention is most effective when it is voluntary, when a person chooses to accept it. So it's like, and the choice to accept it can only come from you. So you have to do that part alone, but the part that you have to do is accept help. So you have to, you know, so it's this weird thing where it's like only you can accept the help. But accepting the help is kind of the whole.
Well, and there's the greater trick is that like all sort of long-term relationships, you have to re-accept the help. You have to continually accept the help because you're going to not want to at some point. You know, you get these bursts of like, things are going great. I can't believe I'm making such strides. You know, I've had these amazing revelations in my life. And then it gets hard again, and then it gets a slog again, and then you don't want to do it anymore, and you want to give up, and you don't trust your therapist anymore because he doesn't know what he's talking about, and blah, blah, blah. And those are the tricky moments. Those are the moments when you have to re-choose to, you know, recommit to the process, to helping yourself. And, you know, it may be that the therapist that you're talking with right now isn't actually being helpful to you. And that's another tricky thing because then you feel like, oh shit, maybe no therapy is helpful to me. Or I can choose another person and start all the way over again. And that can be the most daunting thing in the world.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, you can also be in therapy and just feel like, okay, I've started, I've committed to it, this is good. And then you start to see, you know, the picture starts to form of how deep your hole is. Because once there's light at the end of that tunnel, you start to realize how long the tunnel is.
Yeah.
And that can be debilitating and that can be frustrating and terrifying. And, you know, you might think you'll never get to the end of the tunnel. And the truth is, there is no end of the tunnel. It's a journey. It's not a destination.
Yeah.
Healthy, you know, there's no such thing as like, oh, I have achieved mental health. I'm done. It's all over.
I graduated. I graduated therapy.
That's right. Yeah. I did it and I've got my diploma and now I don't need anything anymore. I'm healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a continual gradual process. And that's another, I mean, that's a big thing that I think that there's a lot of things that I think, you know, 12-step programs get right. And one is, you know, just kind of the one day at a time thing, just because it's like, that's the only way you'll ever do anything in your life. It's the only way you'll ever stay married for any considerable amount of time. That's the only way you'll ever figure out how to raise a kid is just like, you just got to show up for it one day at a time. It's the only way you'll ever figure out whether or not you can really do this job that you're like, that you get a promotion and you're like, I don't know if I'm capable, if I'm the right person for this. It's like, well, show up and just see what happens. And you have to do that every day. And that on the outset is a very daunting proposition because it's meant to make it simple. It's meant to break it down into easy, digestible little units of time. But to a person who's really buried in just kind of the routine of depression and anxiety and self-hatred and self-doubt, it's very, very difficult to even make it through the first day. let alone to put together 2 or 3 or 4 days of consistently going to therapy or consistently, you know, waking up in the morning and going on a jog or like, wait, you know, it's very difficult. And I mean, I don't know about you, about what's happening to you currently, but my personal quarantine process started out very positive. It was like, cool, I'm going to utilize this free time. And I think I've seen this like everywhere that people are talking about this, that it's like, I'm going to get in the best shape I've been in years. Cause why wouldn't I? I've got nothing but time. I might as well do 100 crunches a day and get some abs while I'm waiting to go back to work. Like I'm going to finish all my creative projects. I'm going to meditate every morning and I'm going to get really connected. And I think my first like 2 or 3 weeks of quarantine were like that. And I remember talking to people on Zoom and being like, I'm doing great. I don't know. I feel great. And it, as that started sliding off and as I started feeling good, but also as just I started getting bored and the slog of the days continued, it's become more and more difficult to show up for those daily routines. And there's also this feeling of like, I need to relieve myself of the pressure of feeling like now's the time to fix all my bullshit. And I need to just kind of be like, it's okay if you're a little worried right now. And it's okay if you're a little unmotivated. And it's okay if all you can do is watch the next show on Netflix today and do the dishes. That's okay. Try again tomorrow. But also like the more that I do that, slip into it's okay, I can let myself go. It seems the further I'm getting under the weight of my old pals, my old depression and anxiety. And I don't know if that's been your experience over the last couple months, but
it's been tricky. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, you talked about the quieter voice that is the more healthy voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's interesting because there's like two different kinds of voices that can lead you down a similar looking path. There's the voice that says, oh man, this is just too hard. You should probably let it go. There's actually one voice that's very kind and says, hey man, you didn't do it. It's fine. Don't be hard on yourself. We'll do it again. We'll try again tomorrow. We'll try again next time.
Yeah.
And that voice I love.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the other voice that's like, ugh, this is too hard. It's just too hard. We got to let go. We got to give it up. And that, you know, I have to give up on things a lot. I have to let go of things that I want a lot just because of who I am and you know, acknowledging where I'm at in my process and in what I'm capable of. Mm-hmm. So I have to balance like not being a dick to myself about not having achieved something that I really wanted to achieve with the idea that like I can still pursue, I can still recover and move forward. So sorry, I'm losing my voice here. But yeah, it's a balance. The whole, you know, I figure by the time I'm 90, I will have had something figured out, but you know, you just keep learning. You keep learning which of those little voices is the one that you need and is the one that you need now.
Yeah. Yeah. How are you feeling right now? How have the past couple days been for you? I mean, do you feel like you're kind of in it? Like that it's a little bit on top of you right now, or do you feel like you're, it's a day-to-day thing or,
You know, here's the thing. My depression has not been. It's not sadness, so I'm not. I'm mostly happy right now.
Yeah.
But I do feel my anxiety is very. My chest is very tight a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I'm doing a lot of sighing, like just a lot of just.
Yeah.
Sorts of things, just to sort of let out a little bit of that pressure. And I feel less capable. One of the things that I said in that Facebook post was just like things where if I had encountered it 6 months ago, you know, a year ago, I would have been able to laugh it off and it's no big deal. And whatever I want to fight about, or I want to jump on, or I want to poke at. And And so that's how my depression is showing up and my anxiety is showing up, mm-hmm. is just less ability to hold on to my own self, to comfort and self-soothe, and more irritability and less, you know, more wanting to lash out. You know, it's that sort of reptile brain fight or flight response, and that's and I'm you know, the higher me that isn't a reptile is losing the war sometimes, yeah, to that reptile response.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, it's tough to know. It's sometimes, for me right now, this is the first time in a couple of years that it's been really hard for me to get outside of that. For like 11 years, I lived with that as just like my modus operandi. Like I just, like I operated under just like fear and depression. Like that's just, yeah. And I was sort of resigned to the idea of like, I'm just a person with chronic anxiety and depression, and that's okay. Like I've made it this far in life, muscling it out. Like I think I can just carry this weight through the rest of my days. And I did find that like I can have long stretches of relief through daily consistent hard work. And that's been a really huge change in my life. But the past couple weeks, for whatever reason, it's been really back, like everything you're saying of just like that tightness. And I haven't, now thankfully, and I have to kind of count my wins, I haven't returned to panic attacks or like suicidal ideation. I used to have just almost daily suicidal ideation, and I haven't returned to that. And I used to have panic attacks a few times a week, like 3 or 4 times a week. And I haven't had a panic attack in over almost 2 years. And they haven't returned, but I get the sensation of a burgeoning attack building up and coming up in my throat, and I'm able to sort of, like you said, sigh it off, sort of, and just sort of recognize it and go, there's that. Okay. All right. You know, and just sort of like try to see it and acknowledge it and not continue down the path of flipping the panic switches. And some experience away from it helps me develop modes of getting out of it. Do you have any experience with like full-blown attacks like that, like full-blown panic attacks? You talked about in school, you know, the whole idea of better to just fail than do mediocre. I was a panicky test taker for that, that reason of like, if I can't nail this thing, like everything starts looking like it's written in another language, and I just go, I'm just going to fill in bubbles randomly so I can get out of this room, you know?
Yeah, I have limited experience with panic attacks, with full-on attacks. I have had some. The truth is, my panic attacks are not diagnosed as such. No professional has told me that that's what that is. Mm-hmm. That's how I'm labeling some events that have happened in my life, and I could be wrong about that.
Yeah,
Lord knows I have had some. Fairly recently, actually, I was back when we were allowed to do theater. I don't know if you can remember that time. There was a time,
the before time,
in the world where you were allowed to get on stage with a whole bunch of other people, and there were people sitting in an audience watching you, and that was kind of fun. And I was in a show where, you know, I mean, you know me. Most of my acting has been in what we term straight plays.
Yeah, yeah, meaning
non-musicals.
Uh-huh.
But I sing okay, and I had thought I wanted to get back into musicals, and I got, you know, I was in a couple, and one of them, I just, you know, it's a different process. A musical is a totally different process than a straight play, and
right.
I was finding that I wasn't finding my footing, and the rehearsal process kept being weird in ways that I wasn't expecting, and my anxiety level kept rising and rising and rising, and I found that I was in the middle of a very long term, days and days long panic. I think if it's days long, it doesn't count as an attack.
Like it was a panic state.
It was just a constant state of, you know, you talk about those voices, they were just screaming, just constant screaming at me. And, you know, I'm trying to learn dance steps and I'm trying to, you know, interact with my fellow actors and, you know, tech isn't going well and different things are happening and things just started crumbling down on me. And then I didn't know my lines. And I, you know, we were about to open a show and I was the lead guy and I had the most, I had more lines than any musical theater show should even have. And I had the bulk of them. It was like, it was fucking Hamlet. I don't know what the hell they were thinking when they wrote that. And I, you know, I had a preview and I think at least one performance, possibly more, where I was really stumbling on my lines. And I've never had that. That was just,
yeah,
which didn't help the panic at all. So, you know, I had to meditate before every show and I had to take new, you know, I did find, thank God, one med that interrupted, you know, I tried a Klonopin,
uh-huh,
which I had never tried before, which interrupted at least the main amount of the screaming. But man, that was, you know, that, so that's my experience with panic is less of a single momentary attack. Although I think I've had one of those and more of just like, well, you're fucked for this week and a half.
Yeah, just
or month or something.
I mean, that's really interesting to hear it taking place over a long period of time because it does sound similar to my experience with, and it, yeah, you're so right to point out that like we're not experts and we're not healthcare professionals. We're literally just offering anecdotal experience and right, just talking about our life being worrisome and occasionally unmotivated or depressed people and what we've done to curtail that or work through it. But my experience with, you know, bursts of panic attacks where they last for, you know, 3 or 4 hours at a time on a given day is it sort of overwhelms and swarms my brain to the point where my sensory awareness is muted. I can't see very well. And it starts to, my eyes start to feel like they're almost vibrating in my skull. And so it's hard. I have to kind of close my eyes and I can't look at people in the face because it's hard to, I'm afraid they're going to like see that that my eyes are bouncing back and forth and I'm just so afraid I start breathing so too heavily. So my extremities start curling in and I start getting the, you know, like, I can't remember what the word is for that, where you lose sensation in your fingertips and your toes and they start to kind of curl in cause you're hyperventilating. And, but I've had experiences like that, like outside of audition rooms where I'm in the room outside and and it's such a weird thing to be out there and think, how many thousands of times have I done this in my life? How many times have I been out here in this room with my picture of myself and my list of things that I've done that I'm ready to go in and hand to them and like with my dumb little scene that I'm gonna say and like how many times do I need to do this you know, dog and pony show before I just get to a point where I'm okay with it. Yeah. And I'm all right with the fact that like, I'm most likely not going to get the job. That's just the way it goes. Like chances are I won't get it. It's fine. I'm not here to get the job. I'm just here to do the audition and just do what I do. But like occasionally, and this would happen to me when I was living in New York, occasionally there would be an audition for like a big thing that in my brain, I'd get it into my head that like, this could be a career changer. This could be a thing that would, you know. And then I'd be outside in the room and all of a sudden I wouldn't know my lines. And I'd be sitting there and I'd be thinking, I can't even think of what I'm supposed to say first. I can't even think of what I'm supposed to say. And I'd pull out the side and I'd look at it and I'd go, yeah, that's right. And then I'd go, I can't think of anything right now. You know, and it's like, and right as I'm in the middle of that, they say, Austin, you know, and I've got to get up and walk in. And it's like, on those days, I just kind of had to take an L. Like I just had to just lose that day because there was no time for me to meditate or collect it or try to soothe what was happening. It was all occurring too fast for me to, and I also didn't have mechanisms in place to really deal with it. I had been taught different things over the years, like EFT tapping. Do you know about that?
I've heard of it. I don't.
You've seen people like, yeah, they tap like their pressure points to. I don't know if it's supposed to realign or draw energy to different spots in your body. To me, what it always seemed to do is like, give me a task to do that isn't freaking out. Give me something to focus on that isn't about how my brain is short-circuiting right now. And I don't know if that's part of what makes stuff like that work, is just a distraction to realign the thinking. But there were times where I wouldn't have time to let those things even work, you know?
Yep. We've made an insane career choice. The fact of the matter is that for guys like us, this is what an insane thing for us to want to do.
Yeah. It's so
dumb.
But
although I will say this, I think that, and you know, you find this with comedians, you find this with actors, with artists in general. It's people who have, you know, the deeper, the more depth of experience you have in life, the more you have to draw from. So, you know, it may be that this is, you know, that it makes us people like you and me anxious, and you know, we have a higher hill to climb to get to it. But once we're there, we have a lot to give. We have a lot to draw from, so we have a lot to sort of give if we do it in a healthy way.
Did you ever have that feeling of, if I get better, I'm going to lose what makes me a good artist? Did you ever have that fear of like, if I...
No, I know lots of people who have.
Yeah.
I certainly have known lots of artists who refused to get help because they thought that all of the good art in them came from their pain and what's funny is, you know, as you go through getting better and healing, you still have all of that pain is still a part of you. It's still in there. You're not feeling it right now, but you don't lose it. But man, I've seen so many people just need to torture themselves, or else they're not gonna be good anymore. They're not gonna be good artists.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was me, 100%. I thought as a songwriter and as a just like, that's my well. That's what feeds me. That's what fuels me. That's where my lyrics come from. That's the muse. And I can't do it without that, you know? and I've kind of found over the last couple of years, like, the opposite is true. I'm so much more able to access that stuff with a clear space than trying to pull it out of the chaos.
It's like trying to show people the water, you know, this bit of water from the well while you're trying to tread the water while you're drowning in it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know what? You're going to do better being outside the well and dipping down into it.
Yeah.
Than like trying to keep yourself above water and try and share some of it while you're doing that.
Yeah. You've heard the thing, like the Hemingway thing that's so romanticized of like, write drunk, edit sober, you know? Come back to it in the morning and look at the brilliance that flowed out, however many typos there may be, but look at what you conjured while you were, you know. And I used to do that. I used to write with like a bottle of Crown Royal in me, you know, and like in my room, like smoking cigarettes and writing. And I'd be like, tomorrow I'm going to come back and fix this. And I would come back, and it's not that it was always just garbage. It's not like it was unusable trash. Like sometimes there was stuff there, but like I found in writing sober that I'm like, oh, I'm just saving myself a lot of work.
Right.
And not having to come back and sift through my, you know, my drunken rambling. And that you're right, that the, well, I am thankful for all of my experiences, and I'm thankful that I do have the experience of knowing what a panic attack feels like, or knowing what it feels like to want to die, or knowing what, you know, like that is a nice thing to be able to draw on from experience and not have to just speculate on, I guess, as an actor and as a writer, or, you know, but also it's like, I don't want to just live there for the rest of my life, you know, for fear that I won't be able to, you know.
Well, and it's almost impossible to tell a young ego this, but I'm old now, so it's like a little bit easier for me to accept that I would rather be a worse actor who's healthy than an amazing actor who's unhealthy.
Hell like, yes.
It's in the end, your life is more important than your art. And that's hard to accept, especially when you're in the throes of everything and nothing, and especially when nothing that you produce feels like it's of value except your art.
Yeah.
It's impossible. It's so, you know, it's so difficult for an ego to accept, I might just be a shit artist at the end of this, and that's better than what's happening now. That's almost impossible, and it's almost never the case, but it's possible. But in the end, I would have.
If
those are the choices, go healthy.
I love that, and it's kind of that debate that happens amongst actors about like method acting, where like you can watch people who fully immerse themselves in the reality of the emotion they're supposed to be playing. So if they're supposed to be playing a psychopath, they go home and they watch just video after video after video of the darkest shit they can find on the internet. And then they come back and they bring that energy to the workspace at the peril of their coworkers. But then people will go, yeah, but did you see how brilliant their performance was? And it's kind of like, well, if there's a way for you to get to a good imitation of it without having to jeopardize the safety of the workspace and the people around you, and maybe it's not quite as pinpoint accurate, I'd prefer the imitation to the real thing, where my coworker or my co-star is so invested in the reality of what we're doing that he or she is a loose cannon, you know, like is.
Yeah, you make an unsafe environment for everybody.
Yeah.
And for what is probably diminishing returns. The truth is that like the person who goes and, you know, wrecks their own brain in their basement for a month, that's no less an imitation than what the rest of us do. It's just a different method, and it's probably very destructive for the self, and it's very destructive for the people around you. And really, you know, I can't imagine that Anthony Hopkins was doing that shit, and he created Hannibal Lecter. So you're going to be okay. Just try acting, my boy, as no one actually said in any real story.
But is that a fake quote? Is that a fake story?
It's probably apocryphal.
What is that? It's Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier, right?
Right.
Yeah. And he was staying up all night for Marathon Man or something, and as the story goes, and Olivier went, try acting, my dear boy. Which you're probably right. It's probably just one of those passed down things. But also, I mean, not to go too off topic here, but there is an element of like, just like you said, it's not too different from what the rest of us do, but there is an element of like, in the moment of, especially on stage, sometimes I've done plays where like there's a scene in the play that requires me to get to a place that's unpleasant. And the ability to separate that from my offstage life needs to be there because I need to be able to both get there. Cause like if the script says my character has a breakdown and is screaming and crying and is like dangerously hyperventilating and breaking down, I want to be able to like put myself in that position safely, but also be able to get out of it when I get off stage, so that if someone comes up and hands me a water bottle, I don't go, get the fuck away from me. You know, it's like you need to, and it's tough. And it's a skill in and of itself to be able to.
It's vital. It's absolutely vital.
Yeah.
You know, and that doesn't mean that it's easy. And that doesn't mean that like you're always cheerful the second you get off stage.
Right.
Cause you know, I've had some roles where I would come home after every show and I would need, you know, I would need half an hour of my wife not saying anything to me for a minute while I just sort of shed all of that and, you know, process through all the things that, you know, all the difficulties that I just went through. But that's just because it's exhausting and it's hard, you know, it's hard work.
Yeah.
But like, if you can't, it's not because I'm investing in making sure that I feel the real emotions that my, I don't even think you can actually do that. I think you can, there are ways of approximating it. There are ways of, you know, getting yourself authentic. You know, you feel the things on stage, but if you yourself are still engaged in that, there's something very wrong. There's something it's not healthy.
Do you ever feel like talking and having conversations like this about depression and anxiety? I think in general, we are kind of go-to. We always say like, talk about it. Talking is helpful. But my fear, like every time I approach a conversation like this, before the conversation even begins, before we even got on the phone, I had anxiety about it. And I think there's some part of me that like gets afraid that if I'm drawing up, even just if I'm conjuring up, even just the image of past times this has happened. So kind of like what you're talking about with acting, where it's like, we can't actually get there. All we can do is hope to like bring it up, is to hope to sort of bring up what it felt like one time when we experienced something similar to this. All we're really trying to do is like pretend really, really well. Mm-hmm. But do you think is that ever a byproduct of having conversations like this for you? Does it always help to vocalize it and to, you know, it's like,
I don't think there's an always for me.
Yeah.
I think the truth is for me that, I'm lucky in that the way that my depression, and anxiety play out, I'm able, a lot of this is the hard work that I've done in therapy and throughout my life, but I'm able to talk about it fairly openly, and not re-experience any of the trauma of it, and because I've worked very hard to sort of process a lot of the trauma that I've dealt with, and so I'm fairly open. It's not, the conversation doesn't have an immediate or overly oppressive effect on me, but it also doesn't have that much of a medicinal effect on me either. You know, I feel it's important to be open and honest. And, you know, when I did that Facebook post, it was because I was struggling and people around me were being affected by it. And I was just like, you know what? If anyone's going to deal with me at all, you just need to know this about me. Right now, my shit sucks.
Yeah.
And I think that that's very useful. Like if you can let the people around you know what you're going through in some way,
yeah,
they may not understand it. They may have no conception of it, but at very least they'll know, it's great. They'll be more forgiving of things. They might have ways to help. Not always, mm-hmm. not usually, but they might. It's a trick that I learned really early on, like elementary school. I would go and tell my teachers what I was struggling with or that I was struggling. Maybe it wasn't elementary. Maybe probably high school. I started to learn to because I, you know, I'm failing and I wanted not to fail. I didn't want to fail in my classes. So I would go up to my teachers and I would say, I couldn't do this. I wasn't able to do the homework. Is there something I can do? And they would, why didn't you do it? And I honestly didn't really know the answer.
Yeah.
So I would just say something. But I got used to going to professors in college and just saying, you know, I have this anxiety and I wasn't able to do this. Is there anything we can do about it? And that sucks and it feels shitty, and some people don't believe you, and mm-hmm. some people think you're making excuses. But what I've learned is when everybody's on the same page about what you're going through, at very least, some people will be able to relate to you in a much better way, and you'll be able to relate to them in a better way, and everybody's more sort of prepared for whatever interactions is going to happen.
Yeah, that actually saved me once in college. I had a professor who had to come to me because I didn't know that good, very useful tool of just letting people know what's going on. Again, sometimes just easier said than done. And especially if
half
you just
the time
don't,
you don't even know yourself what's going on.
Exactly.
You don't even recognize it in your own self. So
it took a teacher coming to me in college and going, hey, what's going on here? Because when we have in-class discussions about the material, you seem to know what you're talking about, and you seem to be able to participate really well. And then on all the quizzes and tests, you bomb. And he was like, so what's going on here? Because I feel like you know the material, and you're not. And I just told him, I was like, I have a very hard time with written exams, and with my whole life in school, I've just sort of panicked in tests, and the questions, I think every question is a trick question. And I start thinking like, well, is he being straightforward with this question? Or does he want me to like read in? Is there like a pun here that I'm not getting? And so I just sort of panic. And he went, okay, why don't you come to my office on days that we're going to have tests before class, and you and I will just talk through the material, and you just tell me what you read and what you got from it, and I'll just see if you did the reading, if you understood. Wow. And it was like, it was such a huge relief to have this guy propose a different way for me to demonstrate the same thing to him, that it was like, just demonstrate to me that you read what I told you to read and that you understood it, you know, which was the point
of
the test.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so funny how, I don't know. It's not funny. The fact of the matter is that the world is crafted for average people. Mm-hmm. There's this sort of maybe 80% of people who fit well into that big middle lane, and school and work and all of these things are sort of built for those people.
Yeah.
And those of us who are on the margins have to figure out tricks. You know what I mean? Like, it's not made for us. So we have to sort out how it's going to work. And, we're two white guys, so we don't have to, we're not on those margins. We at least have a lot of the world is made for us.
Yeah.
But, I think everybody has to find, when you find that the world is not crafted for you, you have to find tricks to get around that.
Yeah, and having people just see you can be so beneficial. And there's so much of this that's like luck. It's just like, like having someone reach out to you is just so beneficial. I found when it comes to the medicinal value of speaking or just saying it out loud, sometimes it isn't medicinal. Sometimes it is just letting someone know where you're at and going, I'm not sure how long I'm going to be in this place, and I'm aware of it, and I'm taking steps to improve, but like right now, just so you know, I'm in the middle of this and I'm not sure how long I'm going to be here. Just letting someone know can be good, like you said, to get everyone on the same page. But also I've had experiences where naming it and saying it out loud does sort of do this weird magic trick of like taking it from inside to outside. And it's almost like pushing it out of my body through my mouth. And like I used to, when I'd be in the throes of a panic attack, it would be helpful to talk to someone about what was happening.
Yeah.
And I had a panic attack on stage once, and it was so scary because every time I stepped on the stage, I was freaking out. My brain was screaming, and I just was kind of saying to myself, just wait till your cue line and then just start speaking, and I think you know what to say. And I would start speaking, and then I would say the line, and then I'd say to myself, good job. Like, you said the right thing. And then, and then I'd get off stage and I'd grab someone, and I'd go, can I talk to you? And they'd, yeah, sure. Because I told people what was happening right away. I said, I'm having a panic attack. I just need to talk to you when I come off stage. And so I'd come off stage and I'd go, yeah, I keep thinking I'm going to throw up, and I keep thinking I need to run off stage and throw up, but I know I can't do that. So I'm having, like, I'm just trying to breathe and like keep my focus. It's hard for me to look at people right now. And like, I'm like, my eyes are, and like just saying it out loud would sort of help lessen the chaos within until I had to go back out on stage. Because it was sort of this situation where I was stuck. I couldn't run away. I couldn't, but there was some sort of magic trick that I found of like.
Absolutely. You're right. I've had that experience very much as well. I've had the experience of, sometimes even just naming it is like a reminder to my own brain, oh, right, that's the thing that's happening. Like, I'll be feeling all of these feelings and, I'll be like really struggling and all of this tension and all of this weight and all of this, you know, and I just feel incapable of things. And then you say it and you're like, oh yeah, it's just that thing. Okay, well, I've dealt with that before. How do I deal with it now? You know, it just frees up. You don't see it as just the state of you. You see it as, oh, that's a thing. Oh, okay, I know how that works.
Right. Yep.
It's not just how you are right now. An old friend that you know, and you know how to deal with it sometimes.
Yeah, it's kind of like what people who teach meditation will try to tell you to think about your thoughts, where it's like, well, don't get upset that you have a thought come in that interrupts the mantra or that interrupts the meditation. Like, that's, you're not going to stop the flow of thoughts. The process here is to try to just be able to recognize them as thoughts, to just try to just see them, so that rather than anger arriving and you're just overwhelmed with anger and there's nothing you can do about it, you can train yourself to take a look at it as, oh, there's anger. Okay, what is that anger stemming from? Is it? It's usually a secondary reaction, so it's usually a response to fear or a response to some kind of trigger making me feel insecure, or you know, like, but like, again, so much easier said than done when right hot rage strikes to go, oh, I'm white hot with rage, you know, like, but the goal being to practice this stuff, to practice, just the mindfulness of,
well, and sometimes you can be in the midst of a white hot rage or a, you know, some sort of very powerful emotion. And you can actually, you know, while that has a hold of you, you can actually start talking about what's happening, even if you're yelling it at, you know, I got in an altercation with a guy at the dog park a little while ago. I was walking my dog taking my dog to the dog park, and my dog, you know, ran to these other dogs. So he was far away from me, and I walked after him, after her, sorry. And she got in a scuffle with some other dogs.
Yeah.
Started by the other dogs, but you know, she was mad about it, and they were growling, and it looked very scary. And I think the other dog nipped at her, so she nipped back. And the other dog's owner picked my dog up and threw her to try and save his dog. Now, I look, and seeing that, just I flipped out. I started yelling, screaming at him, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" and all this stuff. And he's yelling back at me, "Your dog was attacking my dog," and blah, blah, blah. And in the middle of this very heightened thing where I was, you know, we're literally, and he's a big guy, and I, you know, I'm just, part of me is ready to just start fighting physically. And, you know, we're both testing each other to see where we're at. And what was amazing was that in the midst of that, it was like this, "Fuck you, you don't throw another person's dog. What's the matter with you? Well, your dog was attacking my dog. Well, I'm sorry. That was probably really scary for you, but you still can't throw somebody's dog." And the guy's like, "Well, I wasn't really thinking in the moment. I was just scared, and I actually am sorry." And we were still both in the same tone of voice, and we were in the same, like, this heightened thing.
Yeah.
But we actually were de-escalating with our words, even if we couldn't with our emotions. And there was this amazing de-escalation that happened, and we walked away friends, and it was fine. But yeah, we were both sort of yelling apologies at each other angrily as we were going through it. So there are like tricks that you can do to sort of, even when you're in the midst of the craziness, you not all of you has to be in that space.
Yes, I've had many arguments like that with my partner, where I'm in the middle of it and I'm like, I'm already upset, but then I'm like, okay, I actually see why you did that now, and I just realized that I'm afraid and feeling insecure because of this. Well, I'm sorry, but it's like the tone of voice is still where it's at. It's going to need maybe like a walk around the block to come back with a new tone, but. Right. Or you see sometimes in successful online flare-ups, ones that don't just result in defriending or blocking, that process of like starting out with maybe a more ad hominem tone of like, right, "You fucking idiot, you know, and getting to a place of, "Oh, well, I can see based on what you like," a right, place of, "Okay, well, it sounded like you were saying this. Well, I see how why you thought that it sounded like I said that, because I," but that can, you know, be useful to just sound it out, because there's a cacophony of voices in your head screaming. So try to get it out in a linear format that you can look at and see if that helps to get some clarity. Just like talking through something with a therapist and like you said, getting control on the narratives that you tell yourself and on your story, where it's like, okay, I've been telling myself this story this way for years, whether consciously or not, whether I even know that that's the story I'm telling myself. Let's write it down. Let's get it out. Let's look at it. Let's get another person's objective eyes on it and see if we can reframe this, you know, and get some clarity here. The last thing I want to talk about, if you have time, are you good?
Yeah, for a bit.
And this is a this is kind of an uncomfortable thing. And again, it has to be specified again that we're not experts on this, and we're not speaking from a clinical position on this. But is there any part of you that believes that experience with these things exists on a spectrum, and there is a point on the spectrum that's a point of no return, like a point where a person might be beyond helping or saving?
If I'm to examine that honestly, the definitive answer is I have no idea if that's true or not.
Yeah.
It certainly doesn't feel that way for me. Mm-hmm. I've never been in a position where I felt completely irretrievable.
Yeah.
I think I've met people who have been through, or who you know, I know one person whose depression is so treatment resistant that they have been through pretty much every kind of treatment you can imagine. They now go to electroshock treatment, which can be very, very helpful. But they've been going for a long time, and they're still, you know, it's the only thing that has helped at all.
Yeah.
And they're still suffering.
Yeah.
So I don't know the answer to that. It's a wild and crazy world that we live in, and human beings are fragile creatures, and you know, you can get broken. And I think that hope is useful.
Yeah.
And even if hope feels, even if it feels crazy to hope, even if it feels like madness to hope for a better life, I still think it's useful. And I still think I'd rather be an optimist than a fool, and a fool than a pessimist and right.
Absolutely.
So, I don't know. I don't know if there's such a thing as an edge over which you can fall and never return. I know a lot of people have ended their lives,
mm-hmm.
and I certainly don't. I'm not one who's blameful of anyone who chooses that.
Yeah.
But gosh, I you know. In not knowing the answer, I do have great hope for help for people.
I think that's kind of where I have to land as well. I've seen so many people who, if you'd heard the story, you'd think there's no way that person can come back from where they are, and people come back from depths that are unimaginable. I mean, just unimaginable lows and places where their ability to choose otherwise seems completely erased. It just seems like, you know, especially in rooms of like people trying to get recovery from drug addiction, where it's like they tell stories and you're like, how are you sober right now? How are you 4 years sober with this story you're telling me? Because it seems like your proclivity to relapse was so strong, no matter what happened, like no matter how much evidence piled up that you needed to get clean, you just could not do it. And yet here you are. So somehow, some way, something finally broke through. And then on the other side, I've had people and friends who died from these diseases in a place where it was seemingly like, I don't know what we could have done. You know, it just seemed like they had every opportunity. Every person in their life was reaching out and trying to help and trying to get through to them, and it just wasn't getting through, you know? And that's kind of where I go back to that thing that I talked about at the beginning, where it's like, you can't do it without help, but you can't really get help unless you're willing to grab onto it, unless you're willing to reach out. And there's, I've encountered people who it's like, the life raft's here, man. Like we're here. Like we're so ready to like take you in the life raft, but like you gotta be willing to get in. Like you gotta be willing to like at least reach your hand out so we can grab onto you. And if you won't do that, if you're gonna actually strap a rock to your leg and put your hands in your pockets, you know, like, and force us to dive down there and try to grab you and untie, you know, like,
right.
I don't know. It is hard, but I agree with you that I have to land at a place of hope, that it's like, you can come back, you know?
Well, Lord knows, you know, it's, I don't know if you've ever read interviews with people who have attempted suicide, and been unsuccessful.
Yeah.
And this isn't the case for everybody, again, but I've definitely read some accounts of people who were in desperate places and did try to kill themselves. And then when it wasn't successful, that ended up being a turnaround point. You know, it's not the recommended turnaround point for people. That's not a thing to try to get a turnaround point. But,
yeah,
you know, they marched back.
Yep.
Not everybody does, but some people are able to actually like find their way back.
Yep. Yeah.
So I don't know. I have hope. I don't judge anybody for being where they're at.
Absolutely. And it's certainly an issue that two people who aren't experts and who haven't, you know, gone to school for this aren't going to unravel and get to the bottom of in an hour and 15 minutes or hour and 20 minutes of talking about it.
I don't know. If you had asked me in my 20s, I'm sure I would have known the answer for sure.
Exactly. I would have known exactly what people need to do to fix their mental health. I really do appreciate you coming and talking about this, and obviously I'm going to talk about in my intro and outro resources that people can go to if they are looking for help for this.
Great.
And give plenty of disclaimers about, just like you said, like, please don't try to fix your mental health by listening to podcasts or listening to people. Yeah. But going to that point, I do think that it's beneficial just to name it like this and just talk about it as a stance of two people who have anecdotal experience and two people who have been able to find pathways that led to some relief and led to, some.
Can I just, you mentioned resources that you're going to talk about. I'm just going to add one to your list because we talked about religion and how that can be a trauma. There is a resource called Recovering from Religion, which is at recoveringfromreligion.org. They have a lot of different resources, one of which is, I believe they still have it, a way of referring people to therapists, hopefully in your area, but if not in your area, therapists who will talk to you on Skype or whatever, and or Zoom, and those are those are therapists who are non-religious or who at least understand the what they're talking about on that front. So that's a good resource.
Amazing. It's Recovery from Religion, you said?
Mm-hmm.
Recoveryfromreligion.org.
.org, yep.
.org. That's amazing. That's a good one to add to the list. And your podcasts, again, are?
Thank God I'm Atheist is the one that I've been doing for longer than podcasts have existed, it feels like. And then there's the How To Heretic.
How To Heretic.
Look them both up. I think they're decent shows. And
they are.
The people that I work with are delightful. So,
yeah, I really do appreciate it, Dan. I appreciate you coming and talking to me. It means a lot, and I appreciate your openness and your just willingness to dive into something with the full knowledge that we're not gonna like fix it or.
Wait, we didn't fix it?
Yeah.
Well, what the fuck was the point of any of this?
What was the point of this?
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, but it's good. If nothing else, it helped me today a little bit. So
nice.
Again, that website that Dan mentioned was recoveringfromreligion.org, spelled just like it sounds. You can reach out to your healthcare provider and see if there's any therapists in your network that you can start seeing if you're not already seeing a therapist to talk about your anxiety and depression. Reach out to friends and family. There's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-888-273-TALK or 1-888-273-8255. It's a lifeline that yours truly has used before, and it did help. I had to call it once while I was in New York in a particularly bad way, and I was pretty convinced that I was going to end that day by jumping off of a building. And I spent about an hour on the phone with a stranger walking around Midtown, and that person helped me. And all of these things, all of these resources, all of these websites, all of these hotlines, all of these, you know, going to see a therapist, all of this stuff requires that initial impulse of some part of you wanting to reach out. And I know that that is just the hardest part when you're deep in there. It's so difficult to say, just do something, just get up, just get a glass of water, just, you know, change your diet, just start exercising more, when you can barely bring yourself to give a shit in the first place. But if there's any part of you that's capable of reaching out, please do. If you got my number, call me. It's a big part of my program to help people who are feeling bad. Seriously, you'd be helping me by calling me. I'd prefer it. So reach out if you can. And if you're doing better and you see friends who seem like they're doing poorly and maybe can't reach out, try reaching out the other way. If that's something you feel like you can safely take on. All I know is there's no way we're doing this if we're not doing it together. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. The show is mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn at Marmalade Music. You can go to marmalademusicslc.com and tell them that you listen to People Pleaser and get 20% off your first project. Marmalade Music is an audio engineering company that's ready to take your music, your podcast, your EP, your album, your single, whatever your audio project is, they're ready to take it to the next level for you. Again, you go to marmalademusicslc.com, tell them that you listen to People Pleaser to take 20% off your first project. You can also go to austin-archer.com to hear more of my projects, or look up Austin Archer on Spotify or Apple Music. Thanks for listening today. We'll see you next time. Stay safe out there. Love you guys. Bye-bye. Thank you.